October 19, 2012, Vrindavan Nectar of Devotion, Chapter 7, Part 2. They come, they don't come, doesn't matter. That's their business, not my business. Okay, so then number 7 is going to be repeated many times in the list. And tomorrow, Vrindavan Charan Prabhu will give us a little presentation at the beginning of class on these repeated items and the differentiation between them. But here we just see that this is in the first 10, again, most important, to live in a sacred place. And this is especially like where the Ganges flows, which is why Srila Prabhupada is talking about the Ganges. Of course, frequently we are told that if we can't physically live in a sacred place, we should live there with our mind. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about making his home a sacred place. So everyone is enjoined to make their home a sacred place. Wherever you live, make it a sacred place. Accepting only what is necessary. This is fascinating. Really fascinating. Oh, I just want to jump back to number 4 for a second, something I forgot. In number 4, about following the scriptures, Srila Prabhupada quotes this verse, that if someone wants to pose himself as a great devotee without following the authority of the revealed scriptures, his activities will never help him to make progress. Indeed, he will simply create disturbances for the sincere students of devotional service. So this is a very often quoted verse, that devotional service that doesn't reference the scriptures is simply a disturbance in society. It's extremely important not to just make up something in service that's not from the scriptures. Okay, accepting only what's necessary. This is so fascinating because when you read the title, you would think, well, this means in terms of physical things. It means, you know, if I only need 3 kurtas, I don't have 4. But that's not what Srila Prabhupada talks about. What does Prabhupada talk about here? So surprising. What does Prabhupada talk about? Yeah. How much and what kind of service you do. Don't do more than you can do. Don't do more than you can do. Don't burn yourself out. Don't take vows you can't keep. Interesting. I always find this one of the more interesting, surprising, and unexpected sections in all of Srila Prabhupada's books. This one little paragraph for me. Accepting only what's necessary. And Prabhupada saying, don't take a vow to chant too many rounds. Surprising, huh? But do we see people who try to do more than they can do, and what happens to them?
They get burnt out.
They get burnt out, they fall on their face, and then they can't do anything anymore. Okay, well, I'm going to be a sannyasi and a GBC and a guru, and I'm going to not have, you know, and then after a while, they can't do anything anymore. So, better, what's that story, the tortoise and the hare, you know? Slow and steady wins the race. So we want to do what we can maintain. We want to do what we can maintain. So if you think, well, I'm only going to eat khichdi without salt, and then you go to the shop and buy ice cream, I mean, what is the use?
That's a good use.
What is the use? So what you can maintain, do what you can maintain. Better to be honest in a lesser position than to be dishonest in a higher position. You know, if you want money and you want a house and you want the opposite sex, and then get married and just be honest. You know, don't pretend to be something that you're not. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about that, you know, we have social needs, physical needs, intellectual needs, and so forth. Be honest. Much better to be honest. and to stay in Krishna consciousness and achieve the goal than to make something showy. I'm going to chant 150 rounds a day. Prabhupada did not like that kind of thing unless it was genuine. I think I told you the other day about my godbrother who was bragging to Prabhupada, I've memorized the whole Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada said, he didn't even talk to him. Prabhupada would not talk to him. He talked to another devotee. He said, make sure this boy has some practical service. And he wouldn't do it. You know, the manager said to him, can you do some cleaning? And, no, I'm just... And he couldn't maintain anything. So be real. Krishna knows what's real anyway. Observing fasting on Ekadasi. Interesting that this is among the top 10. Interesting that it's among the top 10.
What does that mean?
Oh, were you here yesterday?
Yeah.
You were?
Yeah, I left at the end.
Left at the end. Okay, so there's 10... Yes. There's 20 primary. 10 positive, 10 negative. So these are the most important. So fasting on Ekadasi is put here as among the most important. Yes?
What kind of fasting?
Well, we talked about this the other day, that the only thing Srila Prabhupada demanded of his disciples was to fast from grains and beans. So you could... I remember one sannyasi who was saying that sometimes devotees eat better on Ekadasi. Fancier preparations.
We can make some nice food without grains and beans.
Of course you can make wonderful food without grains and beans.
That's also fasting?
Yes. Yeah. So of course if you want to do more, if you want to say I'm just going to eat fruits, if you want to say I'm not going to eat anything, if you want to say I'm not going to drink water, if you want to say I'm not going to sleep, that's fine. But again, make sure it's something that you can do, that you're not going to get sick, etc., etc., and that you actually find it enlivening, that it works with your health, that it works with your program.
Could that be like sort of sense gratification, like I'm going to do this, I'm going to give up soul?
It can be. That's what happened to me with that vow I was taking. It became sense gratification, and Krishna yelled at me and told me to stop it. So anything you do can become like that. I became proud of it. I mean, for 3 years it was really sweet, and then I became proud of it, and then Krishna said, nope, no more. Goodbye. So any vow you do can become like that. It can become, you know, I am doing this. I am such a great renouncer. That's what happened to Sudama Brahmana. That's why the acharyas say Krishna gave a palace to Sudama Brahmana, because he was very proud of his poverty. So that can be with anything. But you don't hesitate to perform some tapasya because you might be proud of it. That's kind of silly. That reminds me of what Jesus said, which I didn't follow in that case. That, you know, don't proclaim your austerities before others. Well, he was talking specifically about austerities. He was saying if you're fasting, put some oil in your hair and have a nice face or something like that so nobody will know that you're fasting. I don't remember the exact words that Jesus said, but something like that. No, it is. It said put some oil in your hair, specifically. That for sure it said. But in other words, don't walk around like, I'm fasting today, Prabhu. Sometimes Krishna, anyway, I don't think I'll talk about it, but sometimes Krishna will want to reveal what you're doing. Sometimes he'll trick you into revealing what you're doing. But anyway, for whatever his reasons are. For whatever his reasons are. He has different reasons.
If I tell somebody something like that, I just get tested and fail straight away.
Well, sometimes you have to. Sometimes you have to. I'm thinking of a funny story Krishna did to me once, but where, you know, I was going to fast for Ekadasi, and it was a big festival with all this youth. And not only was I fasting, I was chanting 64 rounds, and I thought, how am I going to do this? There's this big festival going on. How am I going to keep to my vow? So I just encouraged everybody to do it with me. That was great. It was great. I think out of maybe the 150 people, maybe 30 stayed up all night. And a lot of people were chanting. I was seeing during the day, many of them were new to Krishna consciousness, and I was seeing a lot of them were just chanting all day. And it ended up being an incredible experience.
Was it a 24-hour retreat?
No, it wasn't 24-hour. It was like a retreat. It was a youth retreat, and maybe a third of the people there were fairly new, and I was one of the leaders of the retreat. And I couldn't follow a full-on ecodasy without telling everybody I was doing it. It just wouldn't have been possible. And so I was stuck with either not do it or tell everybody. So I decided to ask everybody to do it with me, if they wanted to. And many of them chose to. I said, you know, you can do, some of you might just give up food, some of you might give up food and water, some of you might give up food, water, and sleep, some of you might just chant it. You know, take whatever you want. And we had a lot of people. It was one of the most fun times I ever had in Krishna consciousness. But that's, you know, and I know some temples where every ecodasy, there's, I think in Mayapur, it's like that, every ecodasy, there's 24-hour kirtan in the temple room. And there's some other places that do that as well. So, but again, that's, you know, at least from grains and beans. I mean, I had one second generation devotee ask me, what's the point of fasting from grains and beans because we're eating so much nice food anyway, and it's, you know, why bother doing that? And I said, at least you're reminded that there's something special about this day. Even if that's all you do, even if the only thing you're doing is not eating grains and beans, there's something in your consciousness that this day is special. And at some point you might end up saying, hey, this is really a day when I want to dedicate myself more to sadhana. You know, ideally, we'd be in a society where everything closed on ecodasy, just like most of us are in a society where things close on a Sunday, for example, in the West. It's the same concept, you know, the Jewish, Christian, Muslim idea of one day a week where you don't work at your job and you're supposed to be going to your place of worship and prayer. It's the same concept. You know, that this is a day you put everything aside. I mean, the Jews, for their Sabbath, they will not light a fire. They will not turn on a light switch. They will not tear a piece of paper. They will not drive a car. You know, this is a day we don't do any work. We don't do any kind of karma, basically, is the idea. And you just pray all day. So to have some time like that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that one way to be more attentive in your japa is to have some times when all you do is chant japa. Have some ekadasi or Janmashtami when you only chant japa. So, of course, as I say, we're not in a society that facilitates this sort of thing. You know, if you have a job, you can't go to your boss and say, well, it's ekadasi today, I'm not going to come into work. But if you can do this, at least sometimes it's quite nice. But even something. Then, this has always bewildered me, and I don't really have an answer for it. But why number 10 is respect to banyan trees? Of course, Srila Prabhupada's adding in here Tulsi, Amalaka trees, cows, brahmanas, and Vaishnavas. So Srila Prabhupada's adding all that to the banyan trees. And of course, and for many of us, we may live in places in the world where there aren't even any banyan trees. In Hawaii, there's lots of them. All right, so that's the first 10 positive ones. Now going to the first 10 negative ones. So giving up the company of non-devotees. And that Mahaprabhu was asked, how do you know who's a devotee? A satsangatya. Giving up the company of non-devotees. And for many of us who joined the Hare Krishna movement as adults, this was one of our biggest tests in the beginning. What do I do with my family? What do I do with my friends who aren't devotees? How do I give up their company? And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhakti Loka, which is on the Upadeshamrita, talks about, this doesn't mean you never have any dealings with non-devotees. That would be pretty hard. Then you'd have to go into the Himalayas. You know, if you're a preacher, you're dealing with non-devotees, and if you're a householder working in the world, you deal with non-devotees. So, because everyone in our Hare Krishna movement is a preacher, everybody's dealing with non-devotees. But the point is not to become intimate friends with the non-devotees. As soon as you're intimate friends with somebody, you want to please them, and you'll want to please them by taking up their behavior. So, who are the non-devotees? So, non-devotees here, Prabhupada talks about the impersonalists, the demigod worshippers, and just the sense gratifiers. Sense gratifiers means even if they like Krishna. So here he's talking like about the sahajiyas. You know, they chant Hare Krishna, they like Krishna, but they're engaged in illicit sex, intoxication, and so forth.
Is that what sahaja means?
A sahaja basically, yes, is somebody, they like Krishna, they're a devotee of Krishna, but they take everything very cheaply. They often engage in sinful activities in the name of devotion. Well, Krishna had his Ras Lila, so I'm going to have my Ras Lila too. In general in the world, every religion has its sahajiyas. You know, with the Christians, it's like, I love Jesus. And you say, well, what are you doing for him?
But I love him.
So, you know, it's all over the world, there are people like that. Yes? Then you offer respect from a distance. Anyone who chants Hare Krishna, you offer respect. Even if they're a sahajiya, even if they're a mayavadi, even if they're a demigod worshipper. Someone one time says Krishna. Oh, very nice. We should respect all living entities, but especially if somebody one time says the name Krishna, never mind who they are, what they are. Be respectful, but not intimately associating with them. Initiated, whatever. If somebody's engaged in gross sinful activities, you don't become intimately, you don't reveal your intimate thoughts to them, and you don't want to end up acting in such a way that you're going to want to please them. Anyone that we really love, that we're really attached to, we naturally try to please them. And if you get too close to people like that, you'll want to please them by being like them. Yes.
It's some devotees, they don't actually just go around saying they're like love Krishna. They know they're not a pure devotee, but they also might drink tea, coffee, and go to classes, so you also know shouldn't get too close to them.
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on whether or not someone's just weak, then they're the innocent person that you can help. You know. Just like I said, you see everybody as your suppliers, your co-workers, or your customers. So a lot of those people are going to be the non-devotees are your category of customers. So how are you going to deal with customers? You know, they're not co-workers, they're customers. So you don't talk about intimate details of company business with the customers. One should be very careful. I mean, I had one god sister who became a Shaivite. And people do funny things sometimes, just due to bad association. So
is she still there?
Is she still a Shaivite? Yeah. She was American. Her husband's Bengali. They both brought up the Shaivites. They became Shaivites just through bad association. So, you know, bad association can do funny things to you. You know, and I've seen devotees who got into weird preaching about sex also. I can think of two former leaders in our movement who now make very vigorous, you know, and they're not young people, and they make very vigorous propaganda in favor of sex. Someone should be careful. It's not difficult to get off the path with the wrong association. Yes?
Sometimes you see in different places some guests or like people, they dance very, very uncontrollably.
Well, especially here in Vrindavan.
Yes, once I saw a woman, her face is turned pale, it's really like uncontrollable. It's not like acting.
Especially
like,
here in Vrindavan.
I don't know what happened. And once in a small temple in Hong Kong, some ladies like dancing like uncontrollably, that people don't know what to do, just ask her that she wasn't listening.
I don't know. Let the managers deal with it. But here in Vrindavan, I noticed that basically the management tolerates a lot. We probably wouldn't be able to have a temple here in Vrindavan if they didn't tolerate a lot. You know, like in Mayapur, they have all these signs how you have to dress to come in the temple, but we would never try to do that in Vrindavan. People come. It's interesting. It's an interesting place.
my uncle is very strict. I remember once.
My uncle is very strict, very conservative.
But really, some devotees that they dance like you may not. The usual way devotee dance then.
Anyway, it doesn't say anything here about you can't associate with people just because their dancing is a little strange. That's not one of the categories. Anyway, that's not one of the categories here of people you have to avoid. So, but basically, we should avoid people who are mayavadis, who are offenders to Krishna, who are demigod worshippers, or who are propounding sense gratification. Okay, now this Prabhupada's put together. Accepting unfit disciples. Prabhupada said that one should not become dependent on the service of disciples. One should not accept disciples just for name and fame, just so you'll get some service from them. One should not construct many temples, again, just for name and fame, for comfortable life. One should not read many books just to impress other people. So, of course, you know, you can have 10,000 disciples, 100,000 disciples, if you're actually helping them all. Durvasa Muni had, I think, 60,000. So if you're going to help them all in spiritual life, but if you're amassing disciples, so look how many disciples that I have. That's not very good. Or, you know, just trying to impress people with temples. And what I really... of course, Prabhupada also says here that you might accept a disciple who's not quite fit, but you know you can make them fit. And then Prabhupada says something here, which is really... in this connection, and this happened at Radhakund, in this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Maharaj recommends that a spiritual master print books. If one has money, instead of constructing costly temples, one should spend his money for the publication of authorized books in different languages for propagating the Krishna consciousness movement. And in reading this, of course, Srila Prabhupada did also construct costly temples. But Prabhupada emphasized the publishing of books over the printing of temples, over the construction of temples, printing of temples. And I was really meditating on this. What does this mean? I'm not going to discuss what conclusion I came to because it's very radical, but I was really meditating. What would this mean if we really put emphasis on printing books and distributing books rather than constructing temples? What would it mean that ISKCON's mission is? How would we envision that ISKCON would be part of Mahaprabhu's movement if our main emphasis was on books and education rather than temples? Just a little thought. Straightforwardness in ordinary dealings. So having open... not doing things that are shady, dishonest, etc. Especially dealing with money. Open, honest money dealings, legal dealings. We had one leader in some country who was illegally selling visas. And it was risking the legality of our whole movement in that country. So straightforward and ordinary dealings. Equilibrium and loss and gain. And what a statement here. Within the heart of a person who's overpowered by lamentation or anger, there's no possibility of Krishna being manifested. Is that a heavy statement?
I didn't hear it the same.
Okay. Within the heart of a person who is overpowered by lamentation, you have to leave now. Have a lovely trip. We'll see you when?
Monday.
On Monday. Very nice. And please offer my obeisances. Thank you. So Prabhupada says here, within the heart of a person who is overpowered by lamentation or anger, there is no possibility of Krishna being manifest. Have you seen that?
Yes.
That if you get overpowered by anger or overpowered by lamentation, Krishna's gone. What does Krishna say? Your memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost, you fall down into the material pool.
That's the three gates of hell, is that?
What?
Is that because of the three gates of hell? Are they like lust?
It's because you get completely covered by the mode of ignorance. It's like taking a room and putting down curtains.
That means just some material things, not lamenting. You might,
not like Madhavendra Puri lamenting that he hadn't attained Mathura. And then that Ramchandra Puri said, Nasarchajina Kanchati, what are you doing lamenting? How will you attain Brahman? No, you can lament like that. You can lament, where is Krishna? You can do that. That's fine. You can become angry at Kamsa. That's acceptable. And Putana and Trinavarta. You can also become angry at the slaughterhouse keepers and the wine brewers and the... You can be angry at that too, but it should be loving anger. You can have some anger as a preacher.
Lamentation that they're not Krishna.
You can lament that they're not Krishna conscious. Yes, how lovely. Thank you. Okay. Then we have respecting the demigods. They're also devotees. They're also living entities. We shouldn't disrespect them. And what a really important one here, not giving pain to any living entity. Not giving pain to any living entity. So that's difficult because there's a tendency for a materialistic person to want to give pain to other living entities if it puts forward their own agenda. That's a lot of the basis of envy. And this means not giving pain to any other living entity. Does not disturb or cause painful action in the mind of any living entity. Prabhupada says here that people talk about cruelty to animals and then they have slaughterhouses. And you know, we shouldn't pain other living entities by our preaching either.
What do you mean by judging them?
Sometimes in preaching we have to say very heavy things. We have to. I mean, just Prabhupada says some very heavy things in this chapter. What can you do? You can't avoid them, but we should try to present them in such a way that doesn't cause anybody pain. We should never intentionally cause somebody pain. We don't want to have the mood of a preacher and saying, well, this is heavy, and if you don't like it, it causes you pain. Oh well, too bad for you. You know, one of my friends recently said that. Said, well, sometimes people say in my preaching that I'm rude and nasty, but oh well, too bad. So I said, well, you know, we should be careful that we're actually serving people. It's one thing just to just smash everybody over the head and just say, oh, I smashed everybody over the head with Krishna consciousness. But if you're not really helping anybody and you're not, you know, you're not really serving people, that's... Krishna's not going to be pleased with that. Okay, let's go through these. Does a spiritual master have to be present to accept initiation room? Yes. Definitely. Spiritual master does not have to be present to get instructions. Just like we're reading Srila Prabhupada's instructions. Srila Prabhupada is not physically in the room, but initiation means the person has to accept you. Otherwise, how do you know that they're accepting you? So people who claim, oh, well, you can be accepted via Ritvik, actually the Ritvik then is the guru. And we've seen this. There's a group in Hawaii that they have their Ritvik guru, but he's their guru. He's the one who's explaining Krishna consciousness to them. He's the one who's explaining how to surrender to Prabhupada. He's their guru. He's just not being honest that he's the guru. It's very peculiar. What are the levels of devotee who would be spiritual master? How does this relate that life after life they turn up to the earth to help the disciple going back to God? Okay, that's two questions. So as far as life after life, it can be in many forms. Just like Bilva Mangala Thakura had his guru Somagiri, and he spoke through Chintamani. Right? You know that story? No? So Bilvamangala Thakur, in a previous life, he had attained to the level of Baba, but not Prema. He took birth in a family of very, very rich Brahmanas, and he became a little proud by his wealth. And so he was living as a debauch, and he had this girlfriend. Prabhupada says, you say girlfriend, we say prostitute. So he had this girlfriend he was seeing, and he was so in love with this girlfriend that at his father's funeral, he told the priest, hurry up with the funeral, I have something to do. And it was a stormy night, and he went out in the stormy night, and there was no boats because it was pouring. So he grabbed a log and went across the river, and when he realized it wasn't a log, it was a corpse. And when he got to her house, she had thought, oh, he's not coming, it's his father's funeral and it's a bad storm. So she had already gone to bed. The house was locked up, and he's banging on the door, she doesn't hear him. So he sees, oh, there's a rope. So he's crawling up the rope to go to her window. And then when he gets, he sees it's not a rope, it's a snake. So finally he's banging on her window, and she lets him in, and he's all wet. And she says, what did you do? And he told her the whole story. Oh, you know, I told him to hurry up my father's funeral, and I crossed the river on a corpse, and I climbed up your house on a snake because I love you so much. And she said, if you had this much love for God, then you'd be a pure devotee. And as soon as he heard that, because in his past life he had attained Bhava, as soon as he heard that, he immediately said, okay, I'm going. He immediately left. And in his books, he offers obeisances to this girl, Chintamani, as one of his gurus. And Prabhupada said his guru from his previous life, Somagiri, who had initiated him in his previous life, spoke, well, he wasn't, he spoke through her. He inspired her to speak in that. So that can be one way, you know, or can empower someone else. It's not necessarily the same jiva. Remember Prabhupada said guru is not a particular man, guru is the truth. So of course we're also personalists. It's also a particular person who's embodying the truth. There are levels of devotees who could be, of course there are levels. So we say that there's a certain minimum level, and then there's many levels above that. So Prabhupada's giving for us the basic minimum level. The cycle of sin again and defined even each of its stages. I'm finding being different in NOD and what we studied. Okay, so in Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada's talking about how there's the original... I was also referring in my description, I was going back to the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu itself to get the descriptions, that Prabhupada was talking, that Rupa Goswami is talking about, that there's the ignorance, the basic avidya, which is your identity, thinking I'm this body, thinking that I'm the enjoyer. Then there's the general inclination to sin, which comes from being the enjoyer. Then there's the seeds of sin, which is the desire to sin. You're not actually sinning, but you have a sinful desire. Oh, I think I'd like to steal that. Oh, I think I'd like to, you know, do this, do that. Then there's the actual sin. Then there's the reaction to the sin, which is not yet manifested. So that's like if you steal something, but you haven't yet been arrested. Then there's the manifest reaction, which is you're in jail. But the unmanifest reaction also creates further desires to sin. So if you steal something, it creates a habit of stealing. And this is important because each of us has certain sinful tendencies, right? Do each of you find that? You have tendencies, certain tendencies to do certain things that are wrong. Maybe they're gross things and maybe they're subtle things. Some of us struggle with gross things, some of us struggle with subtle things. And where does that tendency come from? And the more you do it, the more the tendency to do it gets reinforced. So, you know, if you go around blaspheming devotees, it also increases your tendency to blaspheme devotees in the future. becomes a habit. So whatever sinful tendencies we have, we should do our best to set up our lives so that we don't act on them. Because acting them tends to reinforce the very problem. But the point is that Krishna consciousness can get rid of sinful situations on all of those levels, ultimately because it gets rid of the avidya. Yeah.
Here, like, what is the meaning of kutam and bijam?
As far as I can understand, the difference between kutam and bijam is very specific. And kutam is general.
But they are sinful reactions, right? In terms of bijam?
They're at two different points in the cycle. So they come from ignorance, they come from wrong identity, but they're reinforced by sinful activities.
But in the cycle, papa comes later on, right? In the cycle, you will find.
Yes, it does. But it again gives impetus to the kutam and bijam.
But that's a reaction, right? In the form of seed?
Okay, so let's say a person is inclined to see violent movies. So when they watch violent movies, it inclines them to see more violent movies. So you can say the kutam and the bijam had to come first. The desire to see violent movies had to come before I see violent movies. But seeing the violent movies also inclines me to see more violent movies. I end up having... So it's at two points in the cycle. Does that make sense to you? Not completely. Anybody else want to help me with this? Oh, hello. Anyone else want to try to help explain this? Anyone else have any thoughts on this? Yes, on the cycle of sin. Yeah, uparabdha karma, it's like it creates a samskara, it creates an impression in the mind. Yeah. You know, I do something wrong, and everything we do, Prabhupada said, has some rasa, has some taste. So I do something wrong, I get some taste from it. So then I'm more inclined to do it again.
It's like you want to eat and gets worse rather than...
That's a good example.
You want to eat and you keep eating.
Yes. And after a while, you can practically not stop scratching, yeah. Whereas if you tolerate it, it will tend to go away. But we're not just trying to tolerate it. We're trying to get rid of the original cause through Krishna consciousness. Just tolerating it will not be sufficient.
Can you categorize kutam bijam, prarabdha and aprarabdha, according to the devotee?
Yes.
Like, it's given an effect which is not yet fructified.
Yes.
So that is aprarabdha.
Yeah, fructified means you're actually getting the result.
Not fructified.
Well, all of them. Kutam, bijam, papam, and aparabdha are all not fructified.
Okay, and the categories of the effect which is lying as seed, that is?
Bijam.
Bijam.
Bijam means seed.
The effect which is already mature.
That's parabdha.
Yeah. And which is almost mature.
That would be aparabdha.
Almost.
Yeah, it's almost mature.
So last two definitions are prarabdha and aprabdha.
Aprabdha is almost mature.
Okay. And which is not yet fructified?
Not yet fructified would be kutam. Well, kutam, bijam, and papam are all not yet fructified.
Papam is a sinful act itself.
It's the act itself, yeah. But the result isn't fructified. But you could say just kutam and bijam are not yet fructified also.
Karma connections we're going to suffer in the next lifetime. So
it may be later in this lifetime also. It might be later in this life.
Jiva Goswami says it
won't be later. But it could also be later in this life. But you're just not experiencing it right now. You said in the future, but future might be 10 years from now and it might be 200 years from now.
It's not like the reactions of this lifetime is already manifested as prarabdha, which we're going to suffer in this lifetime?
Well, you can't put everything like that. Just like if I right now, if I insult you and you punch me, so that's happening immediately. You know, or I eat too much and I get a stomachache. It's not that every reaction comes in another life. Some reactions come immediately. Right? Sometimes you do something wrong and you get a reaction 5 minutes later. You smoke in this life, you get heart disease in this life. You may not necessarily get sick in another life. So, you know, whenever we simplify anything, there's some distortion in it. The law of karma and sin is actually extremely complicated. It's not a very simple... I mean, how do you do this? You know, so Krishna has all these billions of living entities, and our karma is often intertwined. I might not just have general karma, but I might have karma with you, or with her, or with, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I might have karma with a specific jiva. And that jiva has their karma, and how does that all come together? You know, sometimes Krishna brings a whole bunch of people together and there's an earthquake and they all die on the same day in the same way. And how does Krishna do that? How does he, you know, every living entity has their own karma, but yet we experience some karma together. And we experience some karma that we give each other. Sometimes I'm the agent for your karma and you're the agent for my karma, right? Now how does he do that?
Inconceivable.
It is inconceivable. And when do you get reactions? You know, are you going to get reactions in 5 minutes, in 5 years, or in 50 years? Or in 500 years? How does Krishna decide when you get the reactions to either pious or sinful deeds?
So it's not like that.
Well, right now we're not talking about devotees. We're talking in general about karma. But it's very, very complicated. So if you make an absolute statement that whatever sins we do in this life have to be reactions in another life, that's definitely not true. There are some things we do in this life that we get the reactions in this life. And then there's some things even materially that can be adjusted. You know, you can do a sinful act in this life and you can pay for it in this life too in another way, you know. If I break your window, I can go to your house and say I'm sorry and buy you a new window, and then I don't have to suffer some kind of karmic reactions. So there's, just like the government punishes you, then you don't have to suffer from the cosmic government.
When you kill someone,
if the government kills them, but then that life is over. But there's other things. If, you know, if I do some sinful activity and I go to jail in this life, then I don't have to suffer in my next life. I've already suffered. That's the idea of doing atonement. So doing atonement is I voluntarily suffer instead of having some karmic reaction. You know, if I can assume, okay, I'm assuming that I've done... So I'm distracted, all the cows are running. If I'm assuming that I've done something sinful, because we've all done something sinful, and I do some atonement, some prayaschitta, then that diminishes or eliminates whatever sinful reactions that I would have to suffer in upcoming lives. Does one accumulate karma when breaking a codicil by eating grains? I have no idea. I don't know if it's a karmic thing. How is a newcomer supposed to correctly choose a qualified spiritual master if he cannot really discriminate who is advanced and who is not? Very good question. Obviously, Krishna and the Shastra and the Acharyas are all convinced that a neophyte devotee can choose a spiritual master, because it's the beginning of spiritual life, is to choose a spiritual master. Choosing a spiritual master is not something done after you're very advanced. It's something done in the beginning. Initiation means beginning. Initiate means to begin. It's the first item in the list of 64, without which nothing else can happen. So it is assumed by God himself, by all the acharyas, by all the sages who wrote the scriptures, that a beginner, a neophyte in Krishna consciousness and spiritual life is capable of choosing a bona fide spiritual master. Now, having said that, there are degrees of eligibility for devotional service. So if you have the highest degree of eligibility for devotional service, you will also be best equipped to choose a spiritual master. Therefore, there is some advice to know the Shastra. Because you're choosing a spiritual master based on the descriptions of Shastra. So that's why Arjuna is asking the question, how do I know who's a transcendentalist? What is his language? How does he speak? How does he sit? How does he walk? He's asking, what are the symptoms? And Krishna's giving the symptoms. And Arjuna asks the question later, what are the symptoms of those who transcended the modes of material nature? And Krishna gives the symptoms. And Krishna also gives them in the 12th chapter. And they're given throughout the Shastra. So there are directions. This idea that a beginner cannot choose is not a Shastric idea. And the way you choose is you have to spend time observing the person. It's not based on what other people, it's not based on what a committee says, it's not based on who's on a list, it's not based on, you know, well, 1,000 other people have said that this person is a spiritual master, so I'll, if they're, you know, it's like everybody's buying an iPhone, it must be a good thing to buy. It's not like that. It's something that, and Krishna helps you by the grace of Krishna, one gets Guru, by the grace of Guru, one gets Krishna. Krishna helps. Krishna guides. And if you make a mistake, then that's also part of a learning experience. I mean, even so many people who were Prabhupada's disciples, they may have gone to bogus gurus before becoming Prabhupada's disciples. Boy, the cows are really active out there. Is it possible the super soul can give different directions from within than a spiritual master? Sometimes. That happened with Chandananda. So, sometimes. Sometimes. Just like it would even happen with Aswatthama. Where, you know, Bhima's a pure devotee, Yudhisthira's a pure devotee, Krishna's Krishna. Draupadi's a pure devotee, and they're all giving different instructions. So, that may happen sometimes. In this chapter 7, it is mentioned that define the authority of the Vedas is considered atheism. So how can one understand others following different religious groups? So I understand that, like we say, don't blaspheme the Vedic literatures or literatures in pursuance of the Vedic version. That any literature which encourages love of God is considered something that's following the Vedas. So in that respect, we can accept that other religious groups also have bona fide scriptures. Although they may be of a lesser degree and they're not necessarily eternal scriptures. Like Prabhupada said, the Bible and the Quran are not eternal scriptures. But the Bible is teaching love of God and the Quran is teaching love of God on an elementary level. So we're talking here authority of the Vedas, authority of scriptures. Buddha denied the authority of scriptures in general. How can a spiritual master suffer if his disciples not following his orders unless... I don't understand. Why the spiritual master has to suffer if the disciple is misusing his free will? Just like I gave the example that initiating guru is like the admissions officer in a college. So just like someone here at the VIHE decides who can take the classes. So let's say that I come here to teach and, you know, none of you do your reading and nobody comes on time. And people come here and you're, you know, playing the radio loudly in the middle of the class. And you're, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I would go to the people running the project and I'd say, what kind of people are you letting into this class? I'd be upset with them. They'd be in trouble. So Krishna's running the Sampradaya. And if a guru is letting unfit people into the school, he gets in trouble with Krishna. Krishna says, well, you know, because the guru is saying to Krishna and all the previous acharyas, please accept this person. Accept this person as a bona fide student. And if the person is just causing trouble, then the guru gets in trouble. The guru is putting his name on the line. When we get initiated, our guru is putting his name on the line, his own good name, his own honor on the line to Krishna. That this jiva is going to be serious. Because you know, I'm a rascal. I can't just go to Krishna and say, please accept me. I've offended Krishna. So the guru is saying to Krishna, please accept this jiva. And then if I'm still a rascal, if I'm causing trouble to the devotees, and I'm causing a disturbance, you know, then Krishna's going to go to the guru and say, what are you doing letting all these unqualified people in? So the guru gets in trouble. So the guru has responsibility to only initiate qualified people. Now, of course, you can never tell absolutely, but that's part of the guru's responsibility. As I said, you know, you can't be absolutely sure, but at least the guru has to do their best, and the disciples should take it seriously. Disciples should take it seriously that my guru is certifying me to God and to all the previous acharyas.
Can you give up on it?
Yes, you can renounce a disciple. Bhaktivinoda Thakura says that it's the duty of the guru to renounce a rascal disciple. Just like it's the duty of a disciple to renounce a rascal guru. Same thing. I don't remember who that is. But no, it is the duty of the guru sometimes to publicly renounce the disciple. Prabhupada only did that with two disciples. The two disciples that he renounced. He said, then leave, go and enjoy. But that is the duty. There was another disciple also, which Prabhupada didn't exactly renounce him, but he said, he has offended my guru and he will not attain prema for 10,000 verse.
I just wanted to point, if you're a disciple and you see more than one disciple, God, brother or something, in the school, do you have a right to say anything to the spiritual master about him?
That's a very personal relationship. You really have to look at the individual personal relationship. Okay, so we'll finish these questions tomorrow, and we'll be hearing this presentation tomorrow also. What?
Next chapter,
yes, which is about the offenses, which I'm sure most of you are very familiar with. Thank you very much.
Thank you.